Daniel chapter 8, starting from verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the capital, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the banks of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westwards and northwards and southwards. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west, across the face of the whole earth, without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him, and there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it there came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the glorious land. It grew even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. And a host will be given over to it, together with the regular burnt offering, because of transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, "Understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end." And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand up. He said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia, and the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold countenance, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. And he shall cause fearful destruction, and shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it.
Thank you. Please keep Daniel 8 open. You'll also find a handout inside. You can see that this week I've broken the system. It requires two pieces of paper, so you may want to fold that out and have that where you can see it. And welcome back to the book of Daniel. If you weren't here in March, you may think that this is a slightly weird part of the Bible to have washed up in on a Sunday night. Maybe you're thinking, are we really supposed to take that reading seriously? Are we really supposed to learn from it for today? And these are chapters that very often churches quietly ignore, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. And having been doing some work on them, I can see why. So we're going to try and do our best with them over the next few weeks. I'm really glad we are working on them. God's word is important wherever you find it. And actually, even as far as I've got with those chapters, really helps, I think, with understanding the bits that come before. And what I'd like to do tonight, though, recognising they're tricky chapters, is effectively give two talks. You can see that on the handout, I think. You can see there's an introductory talk with points numbered A to D. And that's as we start a new series in Daniel and a slightly shorter chapter in chapter 8, we're going to cover some of the big issues in Daniel. Then after that, there'll be a more normal talk on chapter 8 with points numbered 1 to 3. Okay, so let's dive in. Now, first of all, point A, let me remind you of the story so far. Daniel, he is an exile. He spent his whole adult life working for the pagan imperial government based in Babylon. We get four chapters under Babylonian rule, then one on the very night the Babylonians got destroyed by the Persians, and then one chapter under Persian rule. And then at that point, we start going back in time. We slip back about 10 years. And Daniel starts chapter 7 telling us the dreams and visions that he received. So one from 10 years before Babylon fell. And now in chapter 8, we're at 7 years before Babylon falls. So that's the first timeline on your sheet. Just has the Persians in a dotted line. We've kind of been there, but we've gone back and we're in the Babylonians. And the big markers in Daniel's story that he would want us to know about, they're not actually the lions and the fiery furnaces and the changes of government. The things he cares about most are all about what happens to God's people. And I've put that on that first diagram as well. There's the big event of the exile. The exile was the destruction of everything God had been doing for nearly 1,000 years, since he picked a man called Abraham, made him some promises and says, I'm going to make you a nation in a place and a kingdom. And that has just come to an end in Daniel's lifetime. Destroyed and burned and destroyed. Then the next event that Daniel's waiting for is on there as return. God promised a day when he would bring his people back from exile, the return from exile. In fact, God put a date on it, said it would be 70 years from the exile until the return. Which means when Daniel has this vision today, he knows it is very close, maybe as close as 10 years, depending whether you count it from Daniel's exile or from the destruction of the temple that happened a bit later. We're about a decade to go. So it's an exciting time for Daniel. The return from exile is near. But that sort of simple picture, exile and then return, has been, Kev said, expanded. So we've had our kind of picture of history expanded. I think for Daniel that's something slightly more painful, kind of the kind of expansion that really hurts, because he's had two dreams in chapter 2 and chapter 7 that have complicated his view of world history. Daniel and also Nebuchadnezzar, his boss, they've both had dreams with very similar messages, even though they come decades apart. And that's the second bar you've got on the sheet. They saw a long way into the future. And for Daniel, there weren't dates on there. I put those dates on that we know now looking back. And dates for the next four empires in world history. He was given the name, actually, in our chapter today of the Medo-Persians and of Greece. They're in verse 20 and 21 today. He wouldn't have had the name of the Romans. He had to wait and see. But it's clear, just from that kind of huge view of history, that exile 70 years and then return is not the end of the world. There's still at least two major changes of world government after that happens, which I guess would leave Daniel feeling very, very unsettled and insecure. He thought he'd got to hang on for 70 years, but now he knows there are hundreds of years, at least, of world history still to come. Should he be unsettled and insecure? Well, no, because of B. B, the message so far. And if you weren't here, let me give you the way we summarized it in March. The theological message of Daniel can be summed up in two questions. First question, chapters 3 to 6, who is the boss? Who is the boss? Is Nebuchadnezzar the boss? It looks like he is. He has the armies and the conquests and the ability to throw you in his fiery furnace. But it turns out that God is the boss. And not even sort of gods in general, but the God of Israel. He is the Most High God, even in Babylon, even though the Babylonians conquered his people. A good summary verse is there in chapter 4, printed on your sheet. The Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Nebuchadnezzar is emperor of the world because God wanted him to be. He conquered Jerusalem because God let him. And if he becomes too arrogant, as he does in chapter 4, then God can just lift his finger and drive him mad and take his kingdom away. And if Nebuchadnezzar learns his lesson, as he does, chapter 4, then God can give it back again. The Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. So who is the boss? God is the boss. And next question, what will the boss do? See, it's all very well being the boss, but what is the plan? Even with 500 years of history laid out in advance, it could still look suspiciously random. And the plan is there in both of those big sweep chapters, chapter 2 and chapter 7. The plan is that during the period of Roman rule, under the empire that replaces the Greeks, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. 2 verse 44. Or in chapter 7, there comes one like a son of man, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that will never be destroyed. So what the boss will do is bring an end to history, an end to the progression of good or bad rulers, an end to the suffering caused by sin and war, and he will give the rule to one who is truly good, someone who is a human being in the image of God, someone who comes from heaven, though, and has authority to rule forever. Which makes this book a book ultimately about Jesus. Jesus, who came from heaven during the period of Roman rule and has been given the eternal right to rule the world. Okay, so who is the boss? God. What will the boss do? Jesus. That's what he's going to do. Third thing, C. Is this all too good to be true? Okay, so there is a quick summary of the message of the book so far. God's in charge of history. But over the years, there's been one specific attack on the book of Daniel from people who don't think that God is in charge of history. See, Daniel backs up his message that God is in charge of the future by making some stunning predictions of the future. Predicts over 500 years of world history accurately, and sometimes in stunning detail. There's some of the dates on your handouts. And obviously, if you don't think God is in charge of history, then you won't think he's able to make predictions like that. That should be impossible. So you'll want to say that Daniel isn't about predicting the future, so you'll want to shift the date when it was written until what we have here is really a sort of contemporary bloke who's read the newspapers and written it up and pretended it was written by Daniel hundreds of years before. We've said a little bit about that through the series, and we've said it's impossible to do that completely because, inconveniently, we have copies of Daniel from before the Romans, so he must have at least predicted that bit right, but, you know, maybe, and people are most keen to do it with the really detailed bits, bits like verses 9 to 14 and 23 to 26 in our chapter. They're really keen to say God can't, Daniel can't have predicted that. The events that happened in about 160 BC. They say if we can just push Daniel's writing later than 160 BC, then we can say he kind of fluked the rest and we can go on thinking that God doesn't control history. And in looking for evidence to back that up, you can see why if you don't believe in God, you want to think that's true. Looking for evidence for it, the main suggestion has come from studying the words that Daniel uses. So if we can prove that the real Daniel wouldn't have spoken like this or couldn't have spoken like this, and if we can prove that somebody writing in 160 BC would have done, then we've got evidence the book was written late. So if you find a book, someone tries to sell you a book dated 1901 that uses the words Facebook and internet while at the same time splitting every infinitive and uses verbs made out of nouns like burglarize, then you know that is a fake book. Okay, that's what they're trying to do with Daniel. The first thing to say about that is that, because you'll meet arguments like that, even in Bible commentaries all the time, is when comparative language theory is somebody's best evidence for a theory, then you know they are on shaky ground. Okay, sometimes comparative language evidence can back up a theory you believe for other reasons, but if that's your best evidence, you know they are in real trouble. Because just think how much you need to know before you can make deductions like that with certainty. You have to know a huge amount about how language is used, a huge amount how that very particular language is used, and you need to have lots and lots of data, in particular from the individual writer. You know, you need to know what they wrote on everything and what people like them wrote on everything before you can make comparisons like that. Whereas in Daniel's case, he wrote in three languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, so we need to know a lot about how three languages were used. He wrote quite a short book in a period from which not many books survive at all. And he's also a very unusual person. He is the head of the Imperial Civil Service, who'd been brought up in Mediterranean Israel, then transported hundreds of miles to work for the superpowers of Babylon and then Persia. Okay, can you see already some reasons why Daniel might have an unusually widely travelled vocabulary and unusually sort of distinctive ways of expressing himself? But here we go, if you're not asleep yet. The particular example that's been cited as demanding, that's the word they use, demanding a late date for Daniel, is the use of three Greek words in Daniel chapter 3. The references are on the sheet. There's a list of musical instruments, and in the ESV they're translated as the lyre, the harp, and the bagpipe. Okay, so the idea is maybe those are words like Facebook and internet that shouldn't be used because they haven't been invented yet. The trouble is they have been. So Pythagoras, who's a contemporary of Daniel, he uses one of them. One of the others is used by Homer from many years before. They do exist. But maybe it would be wrong to find them being used in Babylon. Do you get the argument now? Do you get how thin the ice is now? The argument is that until Alexander conquers Persia in the 330s BC, you cannot find Greek words being used in Daniel's part of the world. I'm just going to say that again, just so you can hear quite how bold that is. They say that Daniel, knowing three words of Greek, demands that he wrote after the Greek conquest. There's no other way he could have known those words. Isn't that such a bold claim that it actually becomes just a little bit stupid? Let me give you an example. I know far more than three words of Chinese, even though I've never been closer to China than Delhi. So I know the word dim sum, just checking that is actually Chinese, tom yum, chow mein. I guess most of us here know, are those actually Chinese words? I guess most of us know quite a few words of Chinese, though I actually know quite a lot more Chinese words than that, because I was at school with some people who spoke Chinese, and they taught me to play mahjong in Chinese. So I have some quite weirdly specialist vocabulary, words for sticks and dragons and winds and seasons and colours. I'm happy afterwards to try and prove this individually to you. I can't prove that to you publicly because they also taught me to swear pretty foully in Chinese, and I'm not confident that I can still tell which words are which. So I have this kind of extensive vocabulary. But does the presence of Chinese swear words in the vocabulary of an English clergyman demand that I was born in 2315 after the conquest of the West by China? I don't think so. And Daniel's world doesn't have Greek takeaways in quite the same way we have Chinese takeaways, but there were Greek cities all along the edge of modern Turkey, which was the edge of influence of the emperors of Babylon or Persia. Sometimes those cities are inside their empires. Greek people, as well as Jewish people, were transported hundreds of miles into the middle of that empire. Trade with Greek was massive, especially around the Mediterranean, like Israel, or on the big trade routes, like where Israel is. And from 850 BC, after a big recession, it picks up massively. So it's been going on for hundreds of years. There are also Greek soldiers, Greek mercenaries, all over the eastern Mediterranean, including in Egypt and in Israel. They staff the Assyrian navy. Daniel governs significant Greek communities. And I was thinking about this, and we nearly finished on the language if you're losing it. When I mentioned all this to my wife Claire over breakfast, she studied linguistics and philology at university, including the Greek of the right period. She said, what were the three words? And when I said they were all musical instruments, she awarded the anti-Daniel theologians her double height raised eyebrow, which is her her kind of highest expression of contempt. Because music travels like nothing else. Wandering minstrels with the latest hits, new music technology. A lyre is portable. You can make one in whatever city you come to work in, as a slave or a mercenary or a celebrity painter or architect. And when they ask you what that is with the amazing new sounds, you use your Greek words. That's a lyre. So I think there is no reason to think that Daniel was not written by Daniel in the time that he says he did, when Belshazzar and Cyrus and people like that were on the throne. I know that until we have a kind of certified copy of Daniel buried under a volcano somewhere from before 400 BC, I don't expect Richard Dawkins to hear this sermon and become a Christian, but there just is no strong evidence to push a late date except for his extraordinary ability in predicting the future, which goes with his big claim that God is in charge of the future. Okay, we nearly finished the first talk. How to read Apocalyptic. Okay, if that is a short summary of what the book's been saying, we just need to think a little bit about how the book says it, particularly because chapters 7 to 12 are in a style of writing that we are not very familiar with. We said a little bit about it when we got to chapter 7 before Easter. Since then, I've come across a description that I think fits really well from someone else. We should read these chapters of the Bible and other similar chapters like Mark 13 and much of the book of Revelation. We should read them in the same way we look at surrealist art. Does that make sense? The person I got this from probably knows a lot more about surrealist art than me, but and many of you may know much more about it than me, but I remember having the posters of Salvador Dali on my wall when I was a teenager. Did anyone else do that? It was kind of trying to prove you had some culture. And if you look at those pictures, you see a very weird world. I remember a lot of melting watches and a lot of ants crawling out of different parts of people's bodies. And all of it has a meaning. Somewhere in Dali's interesting and slightly twisted psyche, there are connections, often to his sort of complicated relationship with his mother. One of the ones on my wall, doing a bit of reading now, I learn is called The Enigma of Desire, My Mother, My Mother, My Mother. Quite what that is all about, I think I don't want to know. And you don't read that painting as if Dali was trying to provide you with a passport photo of his mum. You read it as if all the details have significance and meaning, but you expect some strange and distorted features. And one particular feature in Apocalyptic, here's another image I found helpful, is that it's sort of a Dali-esque picture of world history as read through an enormous magnifying glass. Okay, is that confusing? It's as if, as we go through the chapters, he moves his big magnifying glass up and down world history and stops to zoom in on a different parts. When I was younger, there was a picture of me in the paper, first time I ever got in the paper, helping an old people's home, helping an old lady beat me at Scrabble regularly, and she could only play Scrabble with the aid of a magnifying glass the size of her head. And it's there in the photo in the paper that we've still got in a clipping my mum kept. And it goes over the Scrabble letters or your face or whatever it is, and you see clearly in the middle the bit of world history, in our case, that's being focused on. So chapter 7 focuses on one bit of Roman rule. Chapter 8 today focuses on one bit of Greek rule. Chapter 9 will focus on one bit of Persian rule. And chapters 10 to 12 be back on the same bit of Greek rule. And you see clearly in the centre, and the edges are sort of foreshortened and crammed together and hard to work out what's going on. And that's particularly true when you get verses like verse 17 about the end, or verse 19 about the end. In nearly every chapter of Daniel, we're going to meet something about the end. And every time it's going to come right after the bit of world history he's focusing on. And it's clear Daniel isn't confused about that. We have the end straight after Roman history. We have the end straight after Greek history today, which he knows is going to be finished by Roman history afterwards. The end is kind of, we jump to it. We're not supposed to think Daniel's getting his chronology wrong there. Okay, take a pause, take a breath. That's going to bring us to today's passage for 10, maybe 15 minutes. We're going to look at Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8 keeps a lot of that surrealist feel. We're going to have two huge animals fighting, and they're going to be a little bit surreal because they're going to represent individuals, one called Cyrus the Great, the other called Alexander the Great, but they're also going to represent empires and sequences of kings. And what we should expect to see as we look at it is big, vivid lessons from what Daniel tells us about his future and our past. And I've got three lessons, numbered 1 to 3. First lesson, the future is appalling. The future is appalling. Do you see that's where the vision leaves Daniel in verse 27? I wonder if you think it would be spiritually exciting to see visions and know the future. Here's a man who does. And verse 27, he is overcome. He has to take several days off work, which you may think your boss is bad, but when you work for a hostile megalomaniac like Belshazzar, that is not something you do lightly. And then he is left appalled, presumably about the bits he does understand, and confused about the rest. And I did not understand it. And there is a good way to check whether we've really understood what the book of Daniel has been saying to us. And this, I think, is the danger of stopping after chapter 6 or chapter 7, as most series of sermons I've ever been in have done. See, if we're left with a happy story about lions and kings getting their comeuppance, then we haven't really been listening to the book of Daniel as a whole. And that's one reason why we've committed to doing the whole book and why I'm glad we have. See, if I ask you the question, who's the boss? And you say, God is, with enthusiasm, then what I guess is that you assume that God being boss looks pretty much the same as you being boss. See how that works? God is the boss. If you're happy about that, you must assume that God will make the kind of decisions about your life that you would make if you were the boss. You assume that God being boss is good for you, which, viewed over a timescale of hundreds of years, the kind of timescale you've got on your sheet, it is. There's no doubt, is there, that God's plan to rescue a sinful world by sending his son to die so that people who believe in him could be brought to live in a perfect new creation without sickness or suffering or death. There's no doubt that is a good thing, is there? It's good that God is in charge. But the book opens with four young men, maybe not even as old as 10 years old, ripped away from their home and their families and brought to serve a foreign king where their lives will be in danger every single day. A few years after that happens, their home, Jerusalem, is captured again. And it is burned to the ground. And thousands of God's people are murdered or enslaved. And yeah, in Daniel there are lots of happy stories. In the book of Daniel, there are the ones you learned in Sunday school that show that a God who is the boss is able to rescue his people from anything. Even if the ruler of the world says he wants his pets to eat you, they can't. Unless God lets them. Do you remember way back when Daniel's three friends were about to be killed? They said, our God will save us. And even if he doesn't, he's still God. That's actually the kind of faith the book of Daniel is teaching us. Not that God is on our side, as in God will always do what I want and I'm praying for in every situation, but God is in charge, as in I will trust him whether the things that are happening to me are the things that I want to happen to me or not. He can save me, and even if he doesn't, he is God. See, Daniel teaches for certain that Jesus is going to be the wonderful, perfect ruler of the world one day. And on that day, the experience will match. Our experience of being ruled will match the perfect character of God. It will be love and blessing and peace and rest all over everywhere. But chapters 2 and 7 say that before that, there is going to be a whole load of trouble. That if I was God and I was boss, I would not allow in the life of Charlie. All sorts of trouble that God allows and I would not. And the Babylonian king, for example, who Daniel works for, whose bank guarantees Daniel's pension, he is going to meet a force of nature as described in verse 3 and verse 4. You have this big ram. If you if you've only ever seen sheep from through your window on the motorway, then you won't really understand this. My uncle's farm, we went to try and control the ram one day. We'd to hire a ram to do what rams do, and we had to try and put him back in the van and take him home again. And it was my elderly uncle, my elderly aunt, me, aged 10 and very wimpy, and my brother was the only kind of functioning farmer type in the thing. He was kind of 17, 18 and good at playing rugby. So we tried to get this ram, and rams are just enormous. They're kind of wide and big and heavy and muscular. And we had a go at kind of herding him where we wanted to go. And I was very happy when the ram bolted at my brother rather than me. But I thought, this is good. This is going to end well. The ram knocked my brother clean in the air, feet overhead, left him stranded and headed off across the fields to a happy life somewhere else, miles away. Rams are big. Rams are strong. This ram is heading for Babylon, and it is not going to go well for Babylon. I saw the ram charging westwards and northwards and southwards. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. And this is kind of current affairs when Daniel is writing. So the year that Daniel writes, the third year of Belshazzar, there has been a big event to worry all the Babylonians. A bloke called Cyrus, who is king of Media, a not very important little kingdom, has just conquered his father-in-law's kingdom. It's going to be awkward at the next Christmas, isn't it? But just conquered his father's kingdom, the Persian kingdom, and combined them, a ram with two horns, the one that grew up later, Media, and the greater one, Persia. And so in Babylon, when Daniel has this dream, what they're all worried about, it's as if all the countries east of us started getting together to form one big federal united political force. That's what's going on. It might even, you know, they're worried about it. It might even make them vote against it in big numbers in elections. It's that sort of feeling. Okay, so Medo-Persia is coming. But then, that was a joke about the election, sorry. But then, worse than that, is the goat. So the goat is from verse 5, and he is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great. And I went to the British Museum during this week, which is a nice thing to do, and I went to the room that is entitled The World of Alexander. The World of Alexander. And I was expecting lots of stuff that would help me with this sermon and help me imagine what it must have been like when Alexander came cantering out of the West. Do you see in verse 5, he came across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. The room in the British Museum, The World of Alexander, it is almost entirely about fashion. It's almost entirely about ladies' fashion in the 100 or so years after Alexander the Great conquers the world. And I'm sure Alexander the Great had some kind of interest in ladies' fashion. But I kind of think the big thing about the world of Alexander was the fact that he conquered the world by the age of 33. I think that's probably a big... There is a map in the world of the British Museum, but basically that, you know, that's it. It's otherwise it's statues of girls in cloaks. He conquered the world. If you're not yet 33, and this gives you something to aim at, If you are over 33, then begin feeling inadequate. He took a town, and that's all right, that's fairly normal. Then he takes a region on the edge of the Persian Empire. That's a bit of a problem. Maybe it'll take us 50 years to take that back. And then he wins again and again and again. He wins this huge battle in the sort of armpit of Turkey and Israel. Then he goes and conquers Egypt just because he's got a couple of spare months. Then he comes back up and beats them again and again and again. And the imperial capitals, the places that Daniel knows and worked in, Babylon and Susa, where he goes in this vision, he conquers them all. Do you know what stops him? He gets to India and starts conquering India, and eventually his soldiers say, look, this is just too far away. We want to go home. And so Anxan has to come back and sit in the Persian Empire, where he dies as a young man. And he dies as a young man with no son to take over. And so Daniel's prediction about a split into four comes true as his four generals get a quarter of his kingdom each. And that is world history. And it is appalling. Again, it's quite fun when you read it about it in history books, quite colourful characters. But the message of Daniel and the message of Jesus in Mark 13 and places like it is that this is world history. There will be wars and rumours of wars and regime change, and people, powers will rise and powers will fall. And that is not the end. That is just going to keep happening until Jesus returns and he rules the world. And I think as Christians, it's possible to get a kind of wrong optimism about that obviously couldn't happen here. Surely that's all ended, that we're never going to be invaded. That's what they thought in the Middle Ages. They thought they have this technology. We have knights on horseback. There is no way the barbarians could ever invade us. They said that until Genghis Khan appeared out of the east. And turns out knights on horseback can be shot in the head from behind by a bow and arrow if you're on a horse. Never thought of that. And the superior technology from the east knocked them over. Are we so sure that the nuclear bomb guarantees the end of history? There's no reason why this could not happen again. Might be in different ways, but no reason why it couldn't happen again. But worse still is the descendant of one of the goat's four kingdoms. So verse 24 is probably saying the little horn is not the equal in world power to Alexander the Great. That's true. The person being talked about is not a world conqueror. He's not as important in global human history, but he is far more important to one small race of people called the Jews, who by 160 BC, when this little horn is ruling the Seleucid Empire, were huddled around their city and their temple in Jerusalem. And because he's far more important to them, he is far more important to God, who takes the time out to predict what he'll do 400 years in advance to Daniel. His name is Antiochus. Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes. And this is your life, your future life, Antiochus. And it's clear here that he is the bogeyman, basically. Verses 23 to 25 are a stereotypical description of the evil tyrant. We're going to see more about him in chapters 10 to 12, where he is the sort of hero. But just briefly, he ends up ruling one quarter of that Greek empire that comes out of Alexander's empire. And he's a big winner of campaigns. He gets slightly above himself. You can see in the verses he has bold ideas, bold countenance. He thinks he's very great. He has a go at conquering Egypt, which goes badly. And he's on his way home and through a place called Jerusalem, where they've been not very happy with him. He's in a very bad mood because his war in Egypt has gone badly. And he stops and takes it out on the Jewish nation. So he bans and he burns copies of the Jewish law, verse 12, I think, throwing the truth to the ground. He outlaws the keeping of quite a lot of the laws in it, like the circumcision laws. He prevents the sacrifices from being held in Jerusalem, verse 11. And he overthrows the place of God's sanctuary. In fact, he does that so thoroughly that he has them offer sacrifices to Zeus inside the Jewish temple, which, if you know anything about the Old Testament law and the kind of rules and structures for keeping God's temple holy, you can see how horrendous that would have been for them. Their temple, turned into a pagan altar. Their high priest killed a bloke called Onias, a statue to Zeus in their temple, quite possibly a statue to Antiochus as well, who thought he was God revealed. That's what Epiphanes means, revealing. There's even, I think that's why the verses here that suggest he's going to fight gods, the prince of princes and cast down the stars, we're kind of seeing him as the tyrant to end all tyrants. He's fitting into the Bible's picture of Satan. And there's, if you want a cross-reference for that, Isaiah 14 does the same sort of job with the king of Babylon. He's ending up taking on God because he takes on God's people, which fits into the New Testament pattern that behind occasional human attacks on God's people is actually Satan working through his human agents, even climaxing in the book of Revelation in a figure that gets called the Antichrist. This isn't just a kind of normal human baddie, not just someone who, you know, your favourite who lost the by-election to someone you don't like. And this is the bogeyman, the ultimate tyrant who does horrible things to God's people and God's temple. Just think what that does to Daniel. Daniel is counting the days to the restoration of the temple. Jeremiah has said 70 years, that is not long now, and he's expecting that to be the restoration of Solomon's kingdom, at the beginning of the eternal kingdom of God. The end of the world, basically, that's what he's expecting in a decade. Decades time, we'll have the end of the world, everything will be right again. And then he sees a vision that includes 2,300 evenings and mornings of a sacrilegious butcher like Antiochus Epiphanes. How does that fit? See why he's appalled by the future. And it's ironic, moving on to the second point, it's ironic that Daniel and other apocalyptic literature is often used by people who think they can predict with certainty when the end of the world will come. You know, put a date on it and put it on YouTube, and it's very embarrassing for every other Christian. When actually one of the biggest lessons Daniel had to learn was that the end he expected wasn't the end at all, and it's quite hard to say this event means the end because, point two, the future is repetitive. See, he learns about a much bigger span of history beyond just exile and return and then end. He knows that we're going to have Babylon, then Medo-Persia, then Greece, and then Rome. And under the Romans, the Son of Man will appear and God's eternal rule will be set up. But Daniel is left overcome and sick for many days and appalled by what's here. And you'd think he should have a stronger stomach than that. This is the man who lived through the exile, who has heard all about Jerusalem being destroyed. He's fine with the change of government that goes from Babylon to Persia. Well, I think because of the new information he gets here about the little horn. See, maybe he's all right with the idea that world powers are going to change, we'll go Babylon, Persia, Greece. But maybe he's hanging on to the hope that they will leave the Jews alone. They'll leave Jerusalem alone. Even if it won't be kind of the full return of exile and the glory of Solomon, maybe we'll be able to live quiet lives and no one will bother us until the end of the world. But what he now knows is that Jerusalem is going to be repeatedly threatened and troubled and destroyed. There'll be the highs, but there will also be the lows. And there'll be this one event that seems to echo through history, which is the destruction of the temple. So I think we've got at least four of them now. Nebuchadnezzar destroys the temple, the worst day in Jewish history. And then, in chapter 7, he's just been told it's going to happen again under the Romans. Someone is going to do all of that again. And one of the Caesars do it, don't they, in AD 70. But now he's just been told, horror of horrors, in between those two, sorry, there are only three, I counted one twice, in between those two, it's going to happen again. The same pattern, the same repeat. There'll be another little horn, almost exactly the same in his description as the one in chapter 7. There'll be one under Rome, one under Greece. He has to watch in his dream as it all happens again. He's got to know that basically every couple of hundred years, this is going to happen to the three things he cares most about: his city, his temple, and his people. And again, I think there's no reason to think that these patterns cannot keep repeating in our world while we wait for Jesus to come back. Can I wonder if we are too optimistic? Are we right to assume that one of our own rulers here, when placed under the right pressure, couldn't become a little horn type? Do we think that's just impossible in an established democracy full of technologically advanced people? If that's what you think, I suggest you tell that to Berlin in the 1930s. And this week, during the papers, the eldest survivor of the concentration camps died. And the thing that struck me about his story was he wasn't in a concentration camp for 4 years because he was Jewish. Just a good reminder that in those camps they put the Jehovah's Witnesses, that's what he was, the communists, the Jews, and the Christians. We live in a country very similar. It's very recent history. Racially, we're very similar. Our institutions are very similar. Are we really so sure it couldn't happen here under the right circumstances? There are empires that are more beast than man in God's image, and occasionally within them you get a very cunning, very able ruler who decides to take on God and therefore his people. And when that happens, you really need to know that God remains the boss and that his plans are undisturbed. And time is up. You've been very patient. I'm just going to give you the kind of bones of what I'd say under point three, because we've had it in the whole book. The future is restoration. The future is restoration. Jesus predicts the same kind of things, predicts AD 70, but says, I am the Son of Man. I'm coming back. I will rule. And just four things that encourage me. It's known about in advance. Daniel was told in advance. None of it's out of control. It is permitted by God, second thing. Even an Antiochus Epiphanes, even a Nero, even a Hitler is under the control of God, which means actually we've started next week's subject early, haven't we? How can God allow suffering? That's very high on the agenda of Daniel, and that's where we'll be next week. It is cared about in heaven, this kind of suffering. The question in verse 13, how long? How long will this go on? That's a very human question. It's encouraging to know they're asking that question in heaven too. How long will this horrible suffering go on? And it has only, fourth thing, one certain outcome. There'll be a broken tyrant, verse 25, a restoration, verse 14, and back into our right place. I'm going to finish by praying, and then we're going to turn to sing again. Father God, praise you that you are in control of world history. You know it from the beginning. You can tell Daniel what will happen over hundreds of years. And Lord God, please would we trust you even through hard and difficult times ahead, if that's what comes. Trust you that restoration is the future and you have all power now, that we trust you whether you save or whether you don't. We ask this in your Son's name. Amen.